from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago this summer, America covertly overthrew its first foreign government in Iran. Regime change looked good at the time, but in his new book, All the Shah's Men, longtime New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer asserts that 50 years later, America and the world are still paying a price in terrorism and turmoil. Tonight on Point, the astonishing cloak and dagger story of Regime Change 101, Tehran, 1953. First, a closer look at Microsoft's big announcement that it will now award stock instead of stock options to its 50,000 employees. The world's largest software maker made thousands of employees millionaires with options over the years. Now it's pushing back, and others may too. I asked Jay Green, who has covered Microsoft for Business Week for 5 years, how employees at Microsoft headquarters are responding to the change.
I think the employees basically are pretty enthusiastic about it. You got to remember that most of these employees, or all these employees, haven't really seen much stock gain in the last 3 years, so here's a different way to make some money off your stock.
But what kind of money? Microsoft famously made thousands of millionaires, many of them on the value of their stock options. Under this new program, do the employees look forward to making a bundle?
Well, it's going to be a lot less of a bundle, to be sure. You know, crunched some numbers earlier today, and you know, you look at the stock gains in the 90s, Microsoft's shares went from a split-adjusted 60 cents at the beginning of 1990 to $59.19 by the end of the decade. So that's a 100-fold gain. Compared to what they've done in this decade, they've actually been halved. Owning stock is a whole lot better these days than owning options for Microsoft employees.
So explain to us exactly what is it that Steve Ballmer, the CEO there, is now going to be giving Microsoft employees. How will it work?
Sure. Well, the difference is to understand what is an option, what is restricted stock. But essentially right now what an employee is going to get is a stock award, actual shares of stock. In the past, they acquired the right to purchase a stock at a certain price. So if they issued the stock option with a strike price of, say, $50, the employee would have the option to purchase that stock at that price regardless of where the stock was.
So if the stock went up to $100, you doubled your money.
Exactly. And if the stock went down to $25, you were just out of luck.
And your options would be underwater, as they
Correct.
Say, worth nothing.
Right.
Which many of those options are right now. How about the new plan?
Now, the new plan, you just simply get stock, and it'll vest over 5 years. But if the stock is trading at $25, you get a share, it's worth $25, and it goes up and down with the market. And it vests over 5 years, so you get a certain portion of shares throughout that five-year period.
But you won't have the same leverage, not the same likelihood or possibility of that huge uptick you could get with options.
That's right.
Jay, how does this fit into the national picture? Does this mean stock options are history? Microsoft is an awfully big player. When they make a move like this, others are likely to do it as well.
Yeah, and I think it could mean that. I mean, it'll take some time, but there's been some momentum in that direction already. The Financial Accounting Standards Board, which, you know, is the body that rules accounting, has been preparing a new rule that would require mandatory expensing of options, because right now companies basically carry those options or give those options away to employees expense-free. If they're required to expense those options, it makes it a whole lot less attractive for companies to do it. And so there's already been a move in this direction. Certainly, if an iconic company like Microsoft making this announcement, it gives greater impetus to it.
What's the overall impact likely to be on Microsoft employees' compensation?
You know, it'll clearly depend on what happens with the stock price, obviously. But I think you can imagine that it'll be more predictable. It'll be easier for folks to sort of know what they own, when they own it, but there won't be the kind of rapid rises that you saw in the past.
So how does this change Microsoft culture? How does it change American business culture if employees are not walking around with the idea in the back of their head that they may just have a bundle in the waiting?
Well, an interesting question if you look at bigger companies versus smaller companies. So at a smaller company, I think it's a big change because guess what? Smaller companies don't have a lot of money to spend on employees, so offering stock options is a really attractive way to attract talent.
Is it possible that small companies will continue offering options as a rule?
They could. It'll just become a whole lot more expensive for them to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And as it becomes more expensive, it becomes harder for them to attract capital to get their businesses off the ground in the first place.
So does that mean harder for small young companies to hire employees? It may be even a dampening effect on new business creation?
There are clearly those in technology who would argue that and have been arguing that very strongly.
And for big companies?
For big companies like Microsoft, it's just a lot easier to manage this. And I think you will see more and more big companies moving down this road. I saw today that Daimler Chrysler said that they were looking into doing this now. So I think you will see a lot of bigger companies moving down this road.
So maybe this marks the maturation of Microsoft's business, or at least one indicator of that. And for the economy overall, for the American business world overall, does this mean it takes away a casino element, at least in part, doesn't it? Does it make it less exciting?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, although you could argue that what the stock market has done over the past few years has made it a whole lot less exciting, too, or at least less exciting than it was in the 90s.
That's for sure.
But I think that's clearly the direction that regulators are pushing and that I think a lot of companies want. I mean, this is part of the corporate reform movement.
So more stability, perhaps, and as Alan Greenspan, in his critique of stock options, I guess he criticized them for warping management interests, so maybe more upright, long-term management view, but less sizzle.
I think that's probably right. I think that companies will try to align their employees' interests with their shareholders' interests, and I think that long-term probably means there'll be less sizzle.
Does that mean a less entrepreneurial American economy, Jay Green?
There are those who argue that it could. Again, I think it'll be to be seen. I think there are some real challenges for young startup companies, but I also think that if there's a good idea out there, it won't go undone.
Jay Green, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jay Green is Seattle Bureau Chief for Business Week magazine. He spoke with us from Seattle. In August 1953, America orchestrated a coup against Iran's democratically selected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, the rationale to stop communism from spreading to the Middle East. Teddy Roosevelt's grandson and Norman Schwarzkopf's dad toppled Iran's first and so far last democratic leader. Stephen Kinzer asserts in his new book, All the Shah's Men, that original regime change spawned a deep anti-Americanism that still festers today. Yet few Americans know how the U.S. government's secret intervention 50 years ago transformed one of the countries in President George Bush's axis of evil. Do we really understand the long-term consequences of regime change? Does the secret history of 1953 make Iran's anger at the United States more understandable today? And is Washington too ready, even now, to see regime change as a quick fix? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Good evening and welcome, Steve Kinzer.
It's great to be back in Boston, even if it's long distance.
It's great to have you, even if it's long distance. It's a terrific book. People may or may not have heard of this coup in 1953, but you bring it to life in a detail that I had never seen before and enjoyed enormously. And you kick it off, Steve Kinzer, right at the top with a quote from Harry Truman saying, "There is nothing new in the world except the history you do not know," which is a kind of mantra that I came back to thinking about it all the way through this book. There's an amazing adventure story at the heart of this. But I want to go first to the kind of conclusion. And you say that in this American-orchestrated coup that took Mossadegh out and put the Shah in 1953, it's right there in your title, you find the roots of Middle East terror. What do you mean by that, Stephen Kinzer?
As you say, in my book, I've tried to do two things. First of all, as I tell the story of what happened in 1953, you can be sure that you're not the only American that doesn't know what happened. Actually, even as I was researching this, I was learning it really for the first time. It's a story that very few Americans are even aware of, even though one that every Iranian is very acutely conscious of.
And even if Americans think they know this story, the detail you've got in here, I found really kind of hair-raising. It's wonderful.
But it's remarkable to me that nobody ever got around to writing a book about this coup all these 50 years. But I can tell you it was just as exciting to write as I hope it is to read.
So there's the adventure story, and we'll get to that. But here you find the roots of this enormous threat of terror today. And I wish you'd explain so that we can think about it as we listen to you tell a bit of the story, how you see that connection between what happened 50 years ago and the terror that we're living with now.
That's the second part of the story that I'm trying to tell. After explaining what happened, I try to look at what it means and what it has meant over the years, these last 50 years since we overthrew the last democratic government in Iran. That intervention set off a chain of very unanticipated events. I think that's really the great lesson. When we intervene in foreign countries, we trigger all sorts of processes and all sorts of trends and events that we can't possibly predict in advance. In this particular case, our coup of 1953 not only put an end to the last democratic government Iran ever had, it also resulted in the placing of the Shah back on his peacock throne in Tehran. His tyranny lasted for 25 years and finally ended in an explosion of anger in 1979 in what we call the Islamic Revolution.
And that part Americans will remember.
Indeed. And the Islamic Revolution was actually won by a very broad coalition, the mullahs and religious fundamentalists who emerged as the government after a short time were not the only faction. That was a real national uprising. There's even a photograph in my book of some of the revolutionaries carrying pictures of Mossadegh to symbolize their desire to get back at the United States 25 years later. Now, after the 1953 coup, it became clear to Iranians that when the United States and the Shah got together, that meant it was there was a coup about to happen. That's exactly what happened in 1953. The United States conspired with the Shah, who had fled the country, and organized a coup to place him back on the throne. Now, in 1979, the United States gave asylum to the Shah. He came to the United States. And then suddenly something happened in Tehran that we Americans couldn't understand. Our embassy was stormed, and our diplomats were held hostage for more than a year. Later on, much later, people who took those hostages have spoken about their motivations. And one of the main things they said was the Shah had left. He was in America. We thought back to 1953. In 1953, when that happened, CIA agents working inside the U.S. Embassy compound in Tehran organized a coup and brought the Shah back.
And it didn't.
We didn't want that to happen again. That's why we stormed the embassy.
Right. And this memory of 1953 doesn't end in 1979. As you say, it brought to power a regime passionately anti-American, theocratic, and embracing terrorism as a tool of statecraft. Iran has helped perpetuate that throughout the region, inspired, as you say, anti-Western fanatics in many countries, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, home of Al-Qaeda. You almost draw a line all the way to 9/11, 2001.
I don't think it's so far-fetched. It was the Shah's tyranny that we imposed and supported over 25 years that led to the explosion of 1979. And it was that fundamentalist, radical anti-American regime that was the product in part of our intervention and our crushing of Iranian democracy that inspired crazed fanatics all over the world, including those in Afghanistan, who saw the Islamic Revolution in Iran as a bright light. They had resigned themselves, like religious fundamentalists in many countries, to life on the sidelines, always a little sect on the outside. Suddenly, they looked at Iran and they saw, we don't have to be a sect. We can take over a government. We can run a whole country. And among those who were inspired that way were the Taliban. And that led, of course, to all the tragedies that we've seen over the last few years. So I think the story of what happened in 1953 stands today as a cautionary lesson. It's a real message to us from the past, and it tells us that long-term consequences of our actions may make what seem at first to be successes look from the perspective of history like disasters.
We are going to come back and get some of the really fascinating detail of what actually unfolded in 1953. It's a beautifully told story and an arresting story in Stephen Kinzer's All the Shah's Men, an American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. We're talking tonight about Washington's original regime change in the Middle East and its long blowback in terrorism and upheaval. You can join the conversation. How do you see the pluses and minuses of regime change as a tool of foreign policy? Is it possible that Washington itself planted the seeds of terrorism that now plagued the world, even planted the seeds of 9/11 in Iran 50 years ago? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Washington's original regime change, the CIA's 1953 ouster of Iran's democratically elected leader and its resonance in the Middle East today. My guest is Stephen Kinzer. He's author of the new book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Stephen Kinzer, there's just an enormous amount of wonderful detail in here. It really is an adventure story in the midst of all this politics and even tragic aftermath that you describe. We'll never get all the detail, but I wish you'd set the stage for us of what was going on in 1951, 52, 53, very quickly, and give us a sense of how this unfolded. I was astonished. First of all, here was this leader, Mossadegh, who was Time's Man of the Year in 1951. 2 years later, the United States is rolling him over. At the Players, you had Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, Kermit Roosevelt, in charge of this operation. General Norman Schwarzkopf's father, right in the middle of this whole thing. Set the scene for us, if you would, Stephen Kinzer, and give us the short course in how this unfolded.
In the early 1950s, when Mohammad Mossadegh was elected as Prime Minister of Iran, the great power in Iran was England, and more specifically, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. This was the biggest and richest British enterprise in the world, and it was the world's largest oil refinery. It had been operating for more than half a century, or nearly half a century, in Iran by this time. It had reaped fabulous profits for the British, but had produced very little for the Iranians.
It wasn't just one refinery. It was essentially Iran's entire oil industry owned by the British.
Not just its own, its industry, but its entire economy, mm-hmm. because that was all Iran had. Mm-hmm. And certainly that was enough to have made Iran a relatively prosperous country had the profits remained in Iran. But actually it was the profits from Iranian oil that allowed the British to reach and maintain a high standard of living over the first half of the 20th century. It didn't do that for the Iranians. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, this produced a lot of social tension and increasing dissatisfaction. That dissatisfaction led in 1951 to Parliament's decision to choose one of its most outstanding members, Mohammad Mossadegh, as Prime Minister. His great cause was the desire to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company.
Put that in perspective. Mohammad Mossadegh can sound like a distant, small figure who got tossed out of office, but you say that in the early 50s, this man was a titanic figure, not just in Iran, but globally.
Put yourself back in a time before Sukarno, before Nkrumah, before Castro. We had never heard any voices from poor countries before. Mm-hmm. Here, this elegant, elderly, tall gentleman speaking in perfect French arrives at the United Nations to persuade the world of the justice of his cause. Then he goes to Washington to meet with President Truman. Then he appears on the cover of Time magazine. He was a really huge figure in 20th century history. And actually, as I was writing this book, I got the feeling that I was resurrecting him a little bit. He was as obscure and unknown to me as he is to every other American, at least of my generation. I actually went out and bought, with some difficulty, the Time magazine cover from the early 1950s, and I've got it up on my wall. As I was writing my book, I felt Mossadegh looking down on me and saying, tell my story.
You know, I wonder if you'll give us a little flavor of this man. On page 123 in your book, Steve Kinzer, you've got a speech that Mossadegh gave at the United Nations. I wonder if you'd be good enough to just read the first paragraph of that speech.
I can't oblige you since I don't have the book handy.
Oh, well, okay.
Nonetheless, it was very eloquent.
And he's saying, look, my country is just scraping by. Here's this enormous resource, oil, and it's all going to a foreign company that's exploiting us. We have to do something about this.
And he was not trying to expropriate without compensation. He actually offered to use the same methods that the British themselves were using at that very time,
the labor
when
government.
They nationalized their energy industries and mm-hmm. their railroads. Mm-hmm. So he was not seizing it. He wanted to negotiate a compensated takeover. Now, what happened? Of course, the British went nuts when this happened. This was there could not have been a greater blow at that time to the British economy. Mm-hmm. So what happened was they decided that they would organize a coup. And they had agents certainly capable of doing that. They spread lots of money around Tehran. They bribed politicians. They bribed religious leaders. They organized paid street mobs. But it didn't take long for Mossadegh to figure out what was happening. He realized that there was only one way he could put an end to this, and that's what he did. He closed the British embassy mm-hmm. and sent all the British diplomats home. among those diplomats were all of Britain's secret agents. So suddenly, Britain had no one on the ground to launch the coup.
They turned to Washington, first to Harry Truman, and he said no.
Harry Truman turns out, in my research, to have been really one of the few heroes of this tale. His attitude was, we don't overthrow governments. That's not what the United States does. You never know what's going to happen when you overthrow a government. We don't take chances in countries that we're not familiar with. We are not long-standing experts on the Middle East. We just don't do that kind of thing. He saw a lot of danger. He was very concerned about Iran. But he always said that nothing could be as dangerous as the long-term results of an American intervention.
And not willing to send American soldiers to stand up for British petroleum exploitation.
The pleas of the Anglo-Iranian oil company and the British diplomats who spoke on its behalf fell on very deaf ears in the Truman administration. Neither Truman nor Secretary of State Dean Acheson believed that they were any more than the bloodsuckers that the Iranians portrayed them as.
But Truman went away. Dwight Eisenhower came, and with him came the Dulles brothers, and a real change in Washington's view.
Indeed. Actually, the British did not even wait for Eisenhower to be sworn in as president before sending the former chief of their intelligence station, who had been booted out of Iran, to Washington to plead his case before the Dulles brothers, Secretary of State and the CIA director, and other members of the incoming administration. Mm-hmm. And this agent actually wrote a memoir in which he referred to this incident, and I quote from it in my book. What he said was that on the plane coming over, he realized that it wouldn't make any sense for him to plead with the Americans, our oil company is suffering unjustly, mm-hmm. therefore you've got to come in and overthrow a government. He decided, I need another argument. And I decided I was going to push the anti-communist argument. I would come and tell the Dulles brothers and the incoming Eisenhower administration that this was a place where they could strike a blow against communism, because even if Mossadegh was not a communist, he was weak, he could be overthrown, there was a lot of turmoil, and of course in a democratic society, Communist Party was existing and other kinds of nationalistic movements were surging forward. Mm. So I will persuade the Americans that they need to do this not for us, but for them.
And it worked like a charm. And quick as a wink, here was Kermit Roosevelt driving from Beirut across the desert to Baghdad as the CIA operative who was to get it done. This was the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. Who was he? Why was he chosen?
Kermit Roosevelt was a young but very accomplished CIA operative. He was the head of the Middle East section of the CIA.
37 at the time.
40 years old. Mm-hmm. And he was a person who had visited Iran a number of times. He had met the Shah, and he also had very good contacts with British intelligence. So therefore, when the British came over to Washington and explained their desire to launch this coup, the Americans were immediately interested, and the British then said, and we've got just the guy. You have this Kermit Roosevelt. We know him. He knows the Middle East. We trust him. Why don't you send him over there to organize the coup? And that's exactly what happened.
He sets up shop in a villa in Tehran, incognito, under a pseudonym, James Lockridge, if I recall correctly. And there ensues this incredible period where he is using the whole network of British operatives to inflame the Iranian press, to get the paid Iranian clerics on fire against Mossadegh, to get the army involved, to have everything churning up, and having these unbelievable midnight meetings with the very timid young Shah.
One of the things this story told me as I was writing it is how vulnerable a young, fledgling democracy is to attempts by highly developed, sophisticated, and very wealthy outsiders to destabilize it. The poor Iranians were just beginning to figure out what a democracy was, and it was really not such a great challenge for Kermit Roosevelt, armed with lots and lots of money, to bribe everybody that needed to be bribed, to organize street riots, and to set Iran on fire. With all of that, what a surprise when his coup failed.
First time out.
Yeah, he had sent a couple of officers to arrest Mossadegh, but news of the plot leaked out. Mm-hmm. The officers were themselves arrested. The Shah fled the country in panic.
Flies to Baghdad.
flies to Baghdad, then on to Rome, where he announces that he's looking for a job because he doesn't have much money and will obviously not be going back to Iran anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And the CIA in Washington is sending Kermit Roosevelt urgent messages telling him, you better get out of there before they find you and kill you all. Kermit Roosevelt replies, I'm going to try again. I think I can still do this thing. And he decides that 3 days later, he's going to try a second stab. Of course, Mossadegh and his people had no idea that there even was someone like Kermit Roosevelt in Iran. They didn't even realize that this plot extended beyond the timid, now disappeared Shah and a few dissident officers.
And not
so they
just
let
in
their
Iran.
Guard down completely.
Yeah, and not just in Iran, this Kermit Roosevelt, but being fed by all the resources of the United States. And at this point is where Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. comes in. He came through with, as you report it anyway, bags full of dollars, lots of greenbacks to pay for this operation.
Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. was really a fascinating figure. This guy was a West Point graduate. He became the commander of the New Jersey State Police, and he reached national celebrity by directing the investigation into the Lindbergh kidnapping. He parlayed that celebrity into, of all things, radio stardom. He became the radio voice of Gangbusters, which was one of the great radio programs of the 1930s and 40s. Then, after World War II began, General Schwarzkopf rejoined the army, and he was sent to Iran to organize a constabulary force, and it became the most elite military unit in Iran. It was essentially a private guard for the Shah, mm-hmm. that is the father of the Shah that we became familiar with later. Mm-hmm. So Schwarzkopf became a very dashing figure on horseback, and years later, when it came time for the CIA to organize the coup, one of their big obstacles was that the Shah was terrified. He was afraid of his own shadow. He wouldn't cooperate with anything. He was too afraid to get involved in anything. Mm-hmm. And the CIA, particularly Kermit Roosevelt, used various emissaries to persuade him. One of them was General Schwarzkopf. The CIA arranged a cover mission for him to be traveling in the Middle East. This was all to disguise the fact that his real mission was to come to Iran, deliver piles of money, and meet with the Shah and demand that he abandon his reluctance and throw himself into this plot.
And get going. So he flies through, bucks up the Shah, drops off a lot of bucks. Meanwhile, Kermit Roosevelt is coming to visit the Shah in the dead of night under a blanket in the backseat of a car. He buys a taxi and is driving around Tehran. He and his guys in Operation Ajax, as you describe it, adopt Luck Be a Lady Tonight from Guys and Dolls as the kind of theme song of their coup, and are drinking vodka and singing this into the night as coups fail. But ultimately, it works. How did they finally turn the key and push Mossadegh out?
I develop a certain admiration for Kermit Roosevelt and his tradecraft. The CIA must have been a very different place then than it is now. It was very new. It was a lot of young, very enthusiastic people. But more important, these agents were operating completely on their own. Mm-hmm. Kermit Roosevelt wasn't reporting back to anybody. There were no communications that allowed that then. Nobody in Washington even knew what he was doing. They had prepared a very elaborate plan for him. That was the plan that failed. Then when he decided to launch another coup in a few days, he was completely on his own. So he was a real-life James Bond operating really on his own. What he did was organize a series of mass rallies on both sides. He organized pro-Mossadegh rallies and anti-Mossadegh rallies so they could attack each other and give the impression that the country was falling into complete chaos.
Turmoil.
Meanwhile, he bribed a number of very senior military officers who brought some tanks and artillery into Tehran. They began firing on government buildings. A large crowd surged through the streets, many of them not realizing that the few pennies they had been paid to turn out that day actually came from the CIA. Mm-hmm. And the climactic battle happened that Thursday night at Mossadegh's house. That lasted several hours, and more than 100 people were killed in the battle right at that house. And late that night, the house was stormed, and Mossadegh fled, only to turn himself into the police a couple of days later. And the new prime minister of Iran, who had been selected by the CIA and the British, took office. And then a couple of days later, the Shah, who had, as I said, thought he was going into lifetime exile, returned in triumph, telling newspaper reporters, "I knew it. They love me."
the timid man is back. Stephen Kinzer, you speculate about what might have been if Mossadegh had been allowed to stay in power, if Iran had not taken this blow to its confidence in the United States, to its own confidence in a democratic future. What do you think might have developed there instead of the Shah and Islamic Revolution and terror and all the rest?
That's a lot to bite off. Of course, history is very hard to look back on and replay. I'd say this. Certainly, there are, in the minds of Iranians, three different options for their government. They can have a monarchy, they can have a democracy, or they can have religious rule. Those are the three options that are facing them, and I think those are the options that face many of the countries in that part of the world. What they learned from 1953 is that democracy isn't going to work because democracy will lead us to ask for things that the outside world, in particular the United States, won't let us have. So we've got to find another way to rule ourselves. And when it came time to overthrow the Shah, there was no great mass movement for democracy because people realized that democracy hadn't worked.
Too much vulnerability.
25 years earlier. Had Mossadegh not been overthrown, I think you can see Iran going in two different directions. One might have been a stabilization of its democracy, a consolidation of some kind of a republican system. Certainly, Iran was in great upheaval during that period, but a great deal of that upheaval was caused by American and British intervention. So if the outside world had left Iran alone, I think it might well have developed into a fairly stable democracy. I look at Turkey as an example, another Muslim country, non-Arab, in the Middle East, that went in a reformist direction. Embraced the principles of democracy and made its way slowly towards that goal.
And what about now, the Soviet Union just north of Iran? Might it not have intervened? Was that just a boogeyman or was there a threat there?
That's the other option that, that people can argue about. And one of the very few surviving planners of this coup made this point when I spoke with him during my research for this book. And I quote him in my book. You've got to realize that in the early 1950s, the world looked very threatening to America. Actually, it looked a lot like it looks now. We had enemies everywhere. The Russians had just gotten the nuclear bomb. The communists had just won the revolution in China. Regimes in Eastern Europe were falling to communism. Leftist movements were growing in various parts of the Third World. So the new Republican administration took office with this sense that it had to strike a blow back. It had to fight back somewhere, somehow. And Iran was the place they chose.
And there it was. There's the story. We have a lot of callers waiting to come into this conversation. We'll turn to them just after a break. We're talking tonight with Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. What do you think? How do you see the pluses and minuses of regime change playing out here as a tool for foreign policy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Washington's original regime change in the Middle East and its long blowback of terrorism and upheaval, the CIA's 1953 ouster of Iran's democratically elected leader, and its resonance in that region and around the world today. My guest is Stephen Kinzer, longtime New York Times foreign correspondent, author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. It's a real thumper of a spy story and a CIA story, but a very serious story behind it of the consequences, often unpredictable, of regime change. You can join this conversation 50 years from now. Will the U.S. intervention in Iraq look more wise than Washington's coup 50 years ago in Iran? How can the United States act firmly in the world without alienating whole nations, whole regions? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mamet is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Mamet. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to start off by saying that what I'm saying is basically from eyewitnesses because of my family.
So you're Iranian by descent, and your family saw what happened in 53?
Well, they were very high in the government at the time.
That is the government of Mohammad Mossadegh?
No, because one of the things I just wanted to correct was that because of the United States policy in Iran before Mossadegh, Iran was a democracy and had three parties, the People's Party, the New Iran Party. There were elections, and the Shah really had very little to do with the government until this affair started.
Absolutely.
And the second thing that I want to say is this, that the Soviet Union and before that Russia were one of the great players in the region from the time of the British Telegraph Company. And for the Soviet Union, Iran was the most important geopolitical site on Earth, its only way of having warm water access year-round and its way of choking the oil supply of the world. And consequently, the Soviet Union had an extraordinary, sophisticated plan for Iran. What made it impossible for the United States not to act was the fact that Mossadegh, any leader in that region, had to use either the Europeans, the British, or the United States, or the Soviets, to play them against each other, Shahzada through the British out using the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, Mossadegh was left with no choice but the Soviets. And at that point in time...
To stand against the British and the Americans,
yeah,
you're saying.
Exactly. I mean, it's just a... It made it impossible, consequently, for the United States not to do anything.
So are you saying, Mehmet, that the Dulles brothers' fear of Soviet influence in Iran was real and justified?
No, it would be irrational to think otherwise. It would be to say that the Soviet Union is going to deny itself the most important geopolitical site on Earth.
All that oil
plus warm water.
All
the supplies that allowed the Soviets to defeat the Germans came through Iran, through the Trans-Iranian Railways.
Mehmet, let's get Stephen Kinzer's response. Stephen Kinzer, there it is. 50 years later, the argument is still front and center. In Mehmet's mind.
Well, I'd just like to say two things. First of all, it may be true that Mossadegh would have had to turn to the Soviets to keep himself defended from the British and the Americans. However, if the Americans had befriended him, he might not have been forced into that situation. Also, Mossadegh was deeply suspicious of the Soviets, and he could have been overthrown conceivably by a leftist, but the idea of him embracing Moscow seems to me very far-fetched. Now, of course, the Soviets did try to seize northern Iran at one time, only a decade or so before the Mossadegh episode, and through diplomacy and intense pressure from Western capitals as well as from Iran, Stalin ordered his troops out of Iran. So there was some precedent for that. However, I do want to finish a point that I was going to make before the break, and your caller brings up very vividly. It's not so far-fetched to put yourself back in the shoes of the American administration in those days and think, we need to act now because if we don't, the Soviets will. History was written one way. We will never know whether the Soviets would have tried to strike against Iran had things gone a different way.
But was there an option of allying with Mossadegh instead of ousting him?
I would argue yes. I think the United States would have been very wise to follow the policy that President Truman prescribed. Embrace Mossadegh, try to encourage him, even though he was a very frustrating figure, and do whatever necessary to avoid the final rupture.
And at that time, as you describe it anyway, Stephen Kinzer, there was a lot of admiration for the United States in Iran. Hard to believe in the decades that we've seen most recently, but the United States was actually seen as an admirable, almost ideal.
It's true. The British and the Russians had more or less carved up Iran at their own political dinner table, and this had been going on for almost a century. And, it was the Americans who were seen as the great golden nation from far away, the one that could do no wrong, the real defenders of democracy. And that was the widespread feeling in Iran right up until the 1953 coup. You can understand why the pendulum swung so radically the other way.
Mehmet, thank you for your perspective and your call. Tom is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening,
good evening,
Tom. And thank you for an offbeat and very informative program as usual. Steve,
good.
I can't help but agree with you more. I spent a lot of time in Iran back in the 70s, and I was astounded to find out what we had done because it just wasn't – I wasn't old enough maybe in 51 through 53 to pay any attention. I wasn't told anything about it in school. One thing you didn't elaborate on that I find appalling is that Norman Sr., you mentioned he established an elite group.
That is Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He also wrote the handbook for what became SAVAK.
The secret police of the Shah.
Ooh. And they would make Hitler's SS troopers look like the Girl Scouts at times.
It must have been something, Stephen Kinzer, when the Middle East saw Norman Schwarzkopf, the general, coming back in with hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops in 1992. What about the Schwarzkopf legacy in this region?
The world looks different from different perspectives. We always think of ourselves as the bearers of democracy and freedom because that's what we enjoy at home. But we're looked at very differently in other countries. Imagine the people in the Middle East having remembered General Norman Schwarzkopf as the commander of the Shah's more or less Praetorian Guard, scourge of dissidents and nationalists and opponents of the Shah. And as your caller says, founder of some of the institutions that became most dreaded and hated in Iran. And then they see his son coming back years later, essentially saying the same thing that the father had said, which is, I'm going to bring order and democracy back to this part of the world. I'm not sure that's something that was taken into consideration when he was appointed, but I can guarantee you that many people in the Middle East slapped themselves on the forehead and said, I don't believe this is happening again.
Can you believe these Americans, generation after generation? Tom, thank you for your call. Jonathan is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Tom, I was interested that you quoted my father saying that it had to do with luck be a lady tonight, which is a quote.
Your father was Kermit Roosevelt?
That's right, yeah.
The self-same?
The self-same, yeah.
Okay.
He's also my grandfather and my brother and my nephew, but in any case, it's my
There's
father.
A lot of Kermits in that family.
All right.
A lot of Kermits in our family.
Was he still singing Luck Be a Lady Tonight as you were growing up, Jonathan?
He was. We had a lot of celebrations about this, and actually I went to Iran with my father, I think in 1954. And met with the Shah after that. And
I imagine the Shah treated you pretty well.
He did, you're right. But in any case, I was interested that your guest, when he spoke about the fact that there were no books written about this, did not mention the book that my father wrote about it called Counter Coup.
I'm sorry, I apologize for that. What I meant to say was that there had been no book written by a non-participant, by an outsider. Kermit Roosevelt did write his memoir, and I quoted from it liberally. And that's one of the documents from which I drew. I don't believe everything that's in there, nor do I think that he expected us all to believe it. Nonetheless, that is a valuable book. It's a valuable source, and it's one of the books that I drew on as I was putting my narrative together.
Jonathan, right. may I ask, did your father live to see the Islamic Revolution in 1979?
Well, my father lived until 2000.
So what did he think of what came after? How do you think he would respond to Stephen Kinzer, who draws the line between the violence of 53 and the violence of 79 and even the violence of 2001 in the Twin Towers?
I honestly think he would have shrugged his shoulders and said, times change. He was quoted at length in David Halberstam's book, The 1950s, in which Halberstam basically attributed an entire chapter of his book to an interview with my father that was as historically suspect as my father's own book, I believe.
A son speaks the truth. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for calling in. Our time is running down.
One other thing,
yes.
Which is I was also in the CIA after my father, and it was just about 2 or 3 years ago that I had my first suspicions that perhaps what happened in 1953 was not a good thing. And it is interesting how times change and how one's perspective changes and how just having time go by gives you more perspective on what might have been correct.
It sure is, and we're getting a lot of that tonight. Jonathan Roosevelt, thank you very much for calling in. Stephen Kinzer, we've just got a minute left. We've just had a new regime change, very different circumstances in Iraq. Your thoughts?
I hope that our intervention in Iraq does not prove to have the long-term effects that the project in Iran has had. I would say this, though. I think anybody that can tell you it won't really doesn't know what they're talking about, because the message we get from the Iran coup and from other interventions that we have launched in places like Chile and Guatemala and many other places is that you never know what's going to happen later. Interfering in the political processes of another country should really be a very, very last resort. When you institute or order or perpetrate regime change, you're doing something like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You never know which way it's going to bounce or what rocks it's going to hit. You are taking a great chance, and this is the chance that Harry Truman said America should not take. He's one of the figures that I think we need to look back on, and the epigram that you cited earlier the only thing new in this world is the history you do not know.
Stephen Kinzer,
we should really be taking into account now.
It's a great piece of perspective. With that, we're out of time. It's a great book as well, All the Shah's Men. Stephen Kinzer, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
In a moment, the new effort to end online music sharing. This is On Point. In the latest attempt to squash online music swapping, the recording industry has begun targeting individual users, suing those that illicitly offer copyrighted files to other users. The effort has yet to stop music piracy. Over 3 million new copies of the file-sharing program Kazaa were downloaded just last week. Techies are working on software that will make users completely anonymous, allowing them to swap without fear. But the industry's new tack has made 19-year-old Princeton sophomore Powell Frazier think twice about clicking on his Kazaa icon, especially after one of the new lawsuits hit close to home.
On April 3rd of this past year, the Recording Industry Association of America filed suit against my college hallmate. Daniel Peng, a 17-year-old computer whiz who skipped two grades before coming to Princeton University, ran a campus-wide search engine that could be used to locate and download songs and movies. The music industry slapped him with a lawsuit seeking potentially billions of dollars in damages for distributing copyrighted works. His site was shut down, and his life was thrown into chaos. Dan, a junior, lived right down the hall from me last semester, and his plight made me rethink the whole issue of sharing music online, instilling in me a deep fear of the RIAA. News of Dan's situation exploded on the Princeton campus. Some students sprinted back to their dorm rooms to wipe their hard disk clean of any record of unauthorized downloads. Those who ran similar sites pulled the plug on their machines and waited, fearfully, to see if they would be targeted next. Others simply shrugged, opened up Kazaa, and went right on swapping music. With Dan's site gone, these bolder souls had simply sought another. But Dan's experience certainly influenced the way I downloaded new music. I started paying for it. Having researched various subscription services for a term paper, I made a quick transition to Roxio's PressPlay client and began to pay a monthly fee for unlimited downloads to their service. This way, I no longer acquired my files illegally and felt safe from litigation. Dan's story, however, was far from over. The industry settled out of court with Dan, who agreed to pay $15,000, significantly less than the billions the industry had originally sought, but a far cry from pocket change for any college student. His next step was to replace his Wake search engine with a page seeking contributions to help pay his settlement. I used my credit card to send him $20, and students nationwide banded together to help Dan, who told me he has now raised over $6,000. A few of us helped him out of sympathy, perhaps inspired by a guilty conscience. Until Dan's case showed us how far the music industry would go to stop internet downloads, a lot of students thought this was an infraction similar to speeding on the highway. The case against Dan persuaded many of us to slow down. Still, when I hear a timeless Beatles classic on the radio and then go home to look for it on Press Play or iTunes and it isn't there, I tend to longingly eye the Kazaa icon that still sits on my desktop, beckoning me to return to piracy. Only fear and Dan Peng's ordeal keep me in line.
Powell Frazier is a sophomore at Princeton University. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.